From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Donald Trump on Friday became the first sitting president to attend the annual March for Life in Washington, D.C. The march is a massive gathering of anti-abortion activists. And with Trump actively courting evangelicals in exchange for political support, he addressed rallygoers saying, quote, "Together we must protect, cherish, and defend the dignity and the sanctity of every human life." Marchers carried signs praising Trump, calling him the most pro-life president ever. My guest is Imani Gandhi. She is the senior legal analyst for Rewire.news, where she covers law and courts, and she also co-hosts Rewire.news' podcast, Boom Lawyered. Welcome to the program, Imani.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So how significant is Trump's attendance? He didn't just attend the march on Friday, he actually spoke.
It's certainly significant for the quote-unquote pro-life crowd. I don't think it holds much significance for those of us who are fighting for reproductive autonomy for pregnant people.
And I guess we shouldn't be surprised by his attendance. It seems as though the more precarious his position, given that this is all happening at the same time that the Senate impeachment trial is happening, he seems to be saying through this move that he is counting on the political support of evangelicals, who he hopes will just overlook the impeachment issue and back him because he's doing everything he can to attack abortion.
Absolutely. This is certainly, I think, partially a distraction to gain headlines as being the first president to ever attend this March for Life. And I think you're absolutely right. He's in a very precarious position with the impeachment trial, with the ongoing impeachment trial, with efforts to, for example, expand the Muslim travel ban. And so, you know, it's really ironic to me to hear President Trump say things like, "We must protect the sanctity of every human life," knowing the way that he has treated, for example, children in detention centers at the border, that he has promised to essentially gut health care for millions of Americans. So the hypocrisy is rather stunning, but it's not unusual given the crowd before which he was speaking.
And should we also acknowledge the fact that the crowd, the evangelical, the Christian, the Catholic, so-called pro-life crowd, overlaps quite heavily with most of his other base, largely white, MAGA hat wearing, conservative. Rewire.news had a piece on your website saying that this march has a race problem.
I mean, the quote unquote pro-life movement in and of itself has a race problem. The way that they use black bodies, black women in their crusade against abortion is frankly quite gross. They often talk, they will say things like, you know, abortion is black genocide, essentially blaming black women for perpetrating some sort of genocide against their own people. And they'll trot out, you know, Alveda King, for example. I mean, they love Alveda King because she's, you know, related to Dr. Martin Luther King, but she holds viewpoints that are anathema to what Dr. King fought for and died for, but they trot her out. And so when she says things like abortion is just like slavery, then it sort of grants white people who probably hold those views sort of a license to be more frank and more forthcoming about those views. And I think it's a really sad way to wield people who have their own autonomy, who want to make their own decisions about how they create families, when they create families, whether they create families, to wield people making those decisions as a weapon in a crusade against a fundamental right, which abortion is. It is a fundamental right. So, you know, the March for Life happens every year, and it generally happens the same week as the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, just to sort of, you know, to spit in the eye of pro-choice advocates and reproductive justice advocates. But quite frankly, you know, when it comes to polling, when it comes to the number of Americans that support abortion rights, we're something like 77%. I mean, the majority of Americans do not want to see abortion criminalized. So the fact of the matter is that these states and these governments that are banning abortion outright, that are creating new felonies for abortion, Ohio has introduced a bill that would create a felony called abortion murder, and then a second felony called aggravated abortion murder. And aggravated abortion murder is a capital offense. So I just really find it hard to believe that states that are willing to put to death people who get abortions are really that concerned about the sanctity of life.
You brought up this conflation between abortion and slavery. So let's talk about Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, who just days before the march, we now know that remarks that she made to a Christian college echoed that same sentiment. She was apparently talking about President Abraham Lincoln, who she said was a hero of hers. She said he too contended with the pro-choice arguments of his day that suggested that a state's choice to be slave or to be free had no moral question, and that she said that Lincoln was right about the slavery choice then, and he would be right about the life choice today. Freedom is not about doing what we want. Freedom is about having the right to do what we ought. Ayanna Pressley had a really great comeback, said, come to the Hill and say that to my face. I was really happy because, of course, not only, you know, she's also the head of the Congressional Abortion Task Force, right?
I mean, I find the abortion is like slavery argument so personally offensive as a Black woman, right? The idea that choosing to terminate a pregnancy, you know, exercising a fundamental right to do with your body what you choose, is the same thing as being forced into slavery, into chattel slavery, sold from white person to white person, basically a victim, a piece of property of white supremacy. The idea that that is anything akin to abortion is preposterous, especially when you take into account the fact that Black women frequently used abortion in order to protect their offspring from white supremacy, from enslavement. I mean, as soon as a Black woman gave birth to a child, that child was not hers. That child was the property of whatever person owned her, whatever person bought her, and that child could be sold away from her and she might never see it again. And so in order to protect their children from being consigned to that fate, Black women frequently not only did, you know, performed abortions on themselves through the use of various medicinal herbs and things of that nature, but frequently committed infanticide, actually killed their newborns rather than consign them to this misery of chattel slavery. So saying that abortion is like slavery basically erases Black women from the slavery narrative. It erases enslaved Black women. It strips Black women of their agency that they chose to exercise in order to protect their own from white people who were foisting slavery on them. So, you know, I'm always very loath to get into arguments about what sort of dead figure would have supported what current policy. You know, I'm not... anti-choicers frequently like to say, well, Martin Luther King would have been against abortion. You don't know that. Nobody knows that. So we certainly don't know what Abraham Lincoln would have thought about abortion. But I do know this, that during Abraham Lincoln's day, the test for life, for personhood, was the quickening. That's when you can feel the fetus moving in your womb. So this idea that any of the framers or any presidents in the 18th century or 19th century would have thought that abortion should be criminalized, or would have thought that an egg or a zygote is a person, is just ahistorical. It's absolutely ahistorical.
There have been more and more women speaking out about their abortions in recent years in reaction to the growing political power of the anti-choice movement, the anti-abortion movement. One of them was Michelle Williams, who at a recent speech talked about how abortion was a really important tool for women who actually do want to get pregnant, for people who actually do want to get pregnant. How important was her speech?
I actually didn't hear her speech, so I can't speak to particularly what she said, but I do know generally the sort of shout your abortion movement that people like Amelia Bonneau started years ago has, I think Lindy West also, has sort of really snowballed into a way that people who otherwise might have been silenced by the stigma surrounding abortion have been able to come forward and talk about their abortion. Renee Bracy Sherman is another huge activist in this area. I mean, and she was very brave. She came out and shouted her abortion. She was one of the first people to do it, and she got savaged for it on social media. And now that it's become more common, she sort of, these earlier women who started talking about the abortion that they had paved the way for people like Michelle Williams to feel like they can stand up and talk about what it is that they went through. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, to sort of center Black women and reproductive justice in this new mechanism for dealing with the stigma of abortion, right? I mean, Black women have always performed abortions and gotten abortions, pardon me for that interruption. And so I think that it is crucial that we center those voices and that we not erase those voices in favor of more mainstream voices, more celebrity voices who are kind of more able to talk about their abortion and be a little bit more insulated from the sort of criticism and savagery that goes on when women speak up about these things. So I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. Yolanda Galt, who's an executive at Planned Parenthood, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times entitled, "I'll Never Be Ashamed of My Abortion." She's a Black woman, although, of course, being an executive at Planned Parenthood also does, you know, put her into that category of being among those privileged women who can talk about it thanks to the work that others have done before them. There's also a study that was recently done showing that the vast majority of women who have abortions are very happy about their decision years later and you know, immediately afterwards and years later.
Absolutely. This idea that anti-choicers have been putting forth that abortion is this horrible, traumatic thing that women are either coerced into having or they're sort of coerced by, you know, radical feminists who are trying to take women out of their rightful place in the home and put them, you know, force them into these career-minded alternatives when really all they want to do is be raising kids. That's just not the reality of what abortion is like in the 21st century. Abortion is very much tied to economic justice. Abortion, unwanted pregnancies, and forcing people to have unwanted pregnancies really does sink those people further into poverty, or into poverty if they weren't impoverished in the first place. So permitting a pregnant person to decide when to have a child is key to that pregnant person's ability to thrive as a full member of society, is an that person's ability to work, that person's ability to raise the children that they already have. Because we have to remember that something like 67% of people who get abortions already have children. So it's not a matter of, you know, sort of promiscuous, loose women who are running around and then getting pregnant. And as a consequence for their choice to have sex, they are being forced, they should be forced to maintain that pregnancy and raise that child. No, these are people who are already struggling to raise children in a country that is really not particularly helpful to people who want to raise children in terms of paid parental leave, in terms of food assistance, public assistance, healthcare, you know, childcare. So this idea that we need to force people who are already struggling to raise children to have more children, but at the same time be unwilling to help them raise those children is, you know, to take it right back to Donald Trump and his speech at the March for Life on Friday, that is something that anyone who's pro-choice should be demanding of people who are anti-choice. What are you doing to make it possible for people to have these kids that you are now going to force them to have? And you can't cut food assistance on one hand, or, you know, repeal the Affordable Care Act and put everyone back into a system where they don't have health care and one medical emergency can drive them bankrupt. You can't do that on one hand, but on the other hand, say we're going to force every pregnant person to have that child no matter what. And once you have that child, then our job is done. We're going to move on to the next fetus and make sure that that fetus is born.
Now, Trump said also on Friday, just to sort of emphasize the lengths to which he will go for the support that he's relying on, he said, "Together we are the voice for the voiceless."
Oh, crying out loud.
So hours before he did this, his administration announced a lawsuit against the state of California over the state's mandate that health insurance companies cover abortion procedures. And of course, to me, this just seemed like red meat for his supporters.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's fascinating that the voiceless never seems to include the pregnant people who are trying to exercise their reproductive autonomy and are being shut down, right? The voiceless never includes patients walking into clinics who are being screamed at and shouted at by what the Roberts Court called sidewalk counselors. And, you know, these people aren't sidewalk counselors. They're fanatics. They're radicals. And they get into the faces of people who are just trying to get into a clinic. I just think that it's interesting that the voiceless never seems to include pregnant people who are trying to seek abortions, pregnant patients who are trying to walk into clinics and navigate this wave of anti-choice fanatics and radicals screaming at them and calling them baby killers. The voiceless always seems to be these, you know, fetuses, embryos, zygotes, but never the people who are carrying them.
Right. So let's also talk about the fact that this issue of health insurance and health justice is part of this conversation, right? At the same time that Trump is trying to sue California for its mandate for health insurance companies to fund abortion procedures, he is slamming the idea of Medicare for all, and of course, dissecting the Affordable Care Act one piece at a time. But when we talk about health and health care, it very much includes reproductive health care. And that's something that needs to be part of the conversation. And health care comes up in our Democratic presidential debates, but rarely as part of reproductive health and reproductive justice, right?
Right. And that's what's very, very frustrating, because there's this concerted effort to castigate abortion rights and reproductive health care as something other than health care. So as something that needs special regulations, that doctors need to go through, you know, these specific hoops and jump over these specific hurdles in order to perform this particular kind of health care. And so the more they're able to separate that out, the more they're able to label it as something other than healthcare, as murder, for example. And so it's very frustrating, because I hear people say all the time, abortion isn't healthcare, but what's the first thing that you do when you find out that you're pregnant, besides either jump for joy or freak out because it's not something you want? You call a doctor. You know what I mean? I mean, it's incredible for people to try and claim that abortion isn't healthcare. So I don't know what the answer is, besides continuing to talk to people and to sort of ask questions that need to be asked. I mean, when we're talking about, for example, the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits federal tax dollars from being used for abortion, it's important to talk to people about that in a way that makes them understand that they're not just opposing, you know, I don't want to have to pay for somebody's abortion. What you're actually in favor of is the discrimination in the delivery of healthcare services against poor people. You're saying that poor people don't deserve the same panoply of healthcare, including reproductive healthcare, as non-poor people do. And I think, and then there have been studies that show that when you approach issues relating to abortion rights from specific frames, from talking about whether or not the government should be involved in a person's decision, whether or not the government should be discriminating against people who want to make a certain decision. That's the way that you change people's minds, if you frame the conversation in the right way. And, you know, to be honest, you know, the pro-choice movement, we're sort of flagging right now. I mean, this is the anti-choice movement's moment. They have their moment. They have their president and Donald Trump, and they've got the momentum behind them. So it requires those of us in the reproductive rights and reproductive justice movement to figure out a way to bridge some of these gaps that have been widening over the past 40 years. I mean, there's definitely a way to talk to people who are quote unquote pro-life about things that we have in common. For example, some pro-life people are anti-contraception, yes, but some pro-life people aren't. And I have to stop saying pro-life because that's not a terminology I like to use.
Anti-choice.
Anti-abortion. Yeah. But there are some anti-choice people who may not want abortion, but they are pro, you know, universal health care. They are pro child care. They are pro food assistance. I mean, there are actually reproductive justice anti-choice activists. I mean, it sounds incongruous, but they are there. There are people who don't believe in abortion, but who do believe in making this country a more hospitable place to raise children. And so those are the people that we need to connect with, and we need to sort of hunker down with and try and figure out a way to get past this. Because if we keep going down this road that we're going, we're really going to end up in a place where abortion is criminalized in, you know, 20 or 25 states. And if it gets particularly bad, if Republicans are able to take over enough state legislatures, then we could be looking at a situation where we have an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that declares an egg a person. And then we're balancing the rights of eggs against the rights of alive, breathing, pregnant people. And, you know, the way the anti-choicers want that fight to go, they want the eggs to win. They want the eggs to have, they want that balancing of rights to tip in favor of unborn, quote unquote, unborn eggs, fetuses, zygotes, blastocysts, what have you.
Cells, just basically different kinds of cells. So I'm wondering, I don't know if you have studied this or even looked at it, but I'm sure you're aware that there now are these state by state efforts to take away access to medical care for transgender youth, for you know, young people and their who have families that support them, who want to get the medical treatment, the puberty blockers or gender reassignment surgery. There are now efforts in several states to criminalize that. And I'm wondering if you see that as part of that same right-wing Christian evangelical anti-abortion movement, or is that a sort of separate issue?
I mean, I think it's all of it is an issue of reproductive justice, right? I mean, one of the tenets of reproductive justice is the ability to raise the children that you have safely and healthily. And if you are raising a trans kid and a trans kid has gender dysphoria and they need puberty blockers or they need whatever medical care that is suitable for them and for their age, and if you're saying you can't have that care, that's a reproductive justice issue. And so I don't think it's a separate issue. I think it's part of, you know, I think it's under the umbrella of reproductive justice. And frankly, I think you're absolutely right that it's just another plank in the evangelical platform. I mean, they're terrified of trans rights. They're terrified of abortion rights. They're terrified of LGB rights. I mean, we see that with the upcoming cases about whether or not it's okay for employers to fire lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans people just for being lesbian, gay, bisexual, right, or trans. So all of this is sort of this this oncoming, this imminent theocracy is what it is. It's just theocracy. It's an attempt to force religious beliefs upon people who don't necessarily hold those religious beliefs. And the Trump administration, you know, the Trump administration has its fingers in that pie as well. They're thinking about executive orders that permit religious discrimination. They issued Department of Labor regulations last year that permit employers, federal employers, to discriminate against people if their religion says that they have to discriminate against someone who's LGBT. So if all of it is connected and all of it is part of this right-wing evangelical attempt to usher in theocracy into this country.
And this is a community that is very, very disciplined about voting. They do get out there on election day, which is what Trump is counting on. Imani, rewire.news is the best place for people to read the work that you do?
Yes, ma'am. Rewire.news. And you can listen to my podcast, Boom Lawyered, with my co-host, Jessica Mason Peeklow.
Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time and analysis.
Oh, happy to be here. Thanks so much.
My guest is Imani Gandhi, senior legal analyst for Rewire.news, where she covers law and the courts. She also co-hosts Rewire.news' podcast, Boom Lawyered. We've been discussing Trump and the March for Life that took place Friday. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.